The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition today. Sad news, we don't have a Social Security question to start off the show, which has been... Well, I guess last week we didn't either, but we got kind of in the habit of doing that. So
I made a mistake.
Oh, we have one?
I found one.
Oh, okay.
It's a weird one. the question isn't weird. It looks like someone copied and pasted the email and printed it because, you know, when you print an email, which is what I do, it tells you... where it's from, the subject, the from, the email address. This is just the question. Bizarre. Mm-hmm. It is from a guy in Chicago. He does indicate that. But I don't know how it got here on the desk. I'm thinking it might have went into Brett, and he copied and pasted it and printed it. But it was up here on the table, mysteriously, because I had told you as I was coming up the stairs, we have no Social Security question, and I come into the room.
Lo and behold, there it is. Maybe the mouse brought it.
The dead mouse? Yeah. It is possible. He heard me and had this hidden in his dead mouse pocket. But it is on an 8.5 by 11 piece of white copy paper. I don't see how the mouse would have hidden that for all these years that he's been dead under the sink. But anyways, we do kind of have a Social Security question. So we'll lead with that.
Perfect.
And it is from George in Chicago. That's all I know.
Okay.
Okay. Did you want to say anything else, or am I ready to jump into the
question? No, we can dive right in.
Dive right in. Okay. Mm-hmm. See, that's what we do, folks, here. No bantering and waste of time on this show. We get right into it. All right. It begins, good morning, Jim and Chris. So I'm guessing he wrote this in the morning.
Well, very perceptive.
Good morning, Jim and Chris. It's nighttime here. No, just kidding. Good morning, Jim and Chris. I am a new listener and love your show. And more importantly... your philosophy towards retirement. Well, thank you, listener. We love it, too. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be practicing it that way. I have a simple question about your advice on taking Social Security early at age 62. Mm-hmm. I'll be 62 in 14 more months. I have two defined benefit pension plans, one of which ran out of room, LOL. I'm not quite sure what he means. It ran out of room. Did he max it out? He can't. There's no more growth of the benefit. That's the only thing that I can think of, Chris. His pension is at its maximum amount. What do you think?
Yeah, I've never heard it referred to that way, but maybe that's how they talk in Chicago.
I guess. I don't know. So we confess, listener, who I don't know who you are.
Hopefully it turns out not to be pertinent to the question. We'll see.
I hope not. I hope this is not from the dead mouse because he might be playing a joke on us. But nonetheless, again, we have no idea who this came from, folks, because it just appeared on my desk. After, did I not tell you, this afternoon as I'm walking up the stairs, we don't have a Social Security question. Okay, where did I leave? Okay, my basic question was, is there a formula or a line of reasoning that I should consider when taking Social Security early versus waiting? This is a very popular subject among my friends and coworkers. Many think that you have to wait and draw your maximum Social Security. But since we never know when our number will be called and we have life to live and are ready to get started, what do you think? Thanks in advance. Love your show. There's no right or wrong answer
Chris. This is actually more of a planning question than a Social Security question in my book, because this is really all about secure income and how are you going to treat that in as part of your overall plan. And so this is, and you know, I guess it's appropriate that we answer this one first because it is Social Security related.
He said the word Social Security in the question.
Exactly. But, well, let me spit out mine since I guess I'm talking first and then you can agree to disagree or add your little flourish, if you will. I would look at it as overall your secure income. The first thing we want to make sure is that you have enough secure income for you and your spouse. I don't think he mentions a spouse.
He does not.
If you have one, include the spouse and your combined minimum dignity floor expenses. Make sure you have enough secure income to protect that throughout your entire life, because that is the most critical batch of expenses you have. You must meet those expenses in order to maintain your level of dignity in life. And those expenses must be met until the very last day that you're alive. And that's where secure income, we feel, is perfect for covering that, because it comes in all the way until the very last day that you're alive. So look at it as a couple. Look at it in survivorship. He didn't share how his pensions behave over time. Sometimes these pensions may not be as robust long-term because they don't have a COLA. Maybe they have a reduced benefit for a spouse or even no benefit at all for the spouse. And look at all of that. Overall, some people then say, well, you know, consider even the kids. I don't quite go down that path so much with secure income because I'm not trying to convince you to cover everything and every, you know, all of your goals with secure income. But at least consider the couple and the individual survivors, either one of you. And if between the pension and age 62 Social Security benefit, which of course is going to be much reduced compared to your age 70 benefit, even claiming at 62, if your current secure income is more than enough to cover your minimum dignity floor in any scenario, the two of you alive, either of you alive independently, then I would say your Social Security decision has become more of a personal decision rather than a financial need situation, assuming that you have enough assets to cover your other things too. He didn't say that he has them. Most people, though, have some assets outside of that. If his goal is he's got to cover everything, including his fund, with secure income, then this kind of changes the story a little bit. But I doubt he'd be contacting us if he had zero assets. Most people aren't that interested in talking about retirement planning when they just have secure income and they're going to turn it on and live their life that way. So he likely has some of those other things. And as long as he's not trying to direct some of the secure income specifically to cover the fund, which isn't really part of our process, although some people end up with enough secure income to do that, it's not part of the goal to, you know, the minimum that we want to see you have. And so then it becomes, what do you prefer? Claiming early, he's going to have a few extra dollars every single month that he could spend on fun. Maybe his two pensions completely cover the minimum dignity floor and the Social Security is just extra. I'd say turn it on whenever you want to. If it's not going to jeopardize the long-term minimum dignity floor, I have no problem with turning it on early. But if you need additional secure income, in this low interest rate environment, one of the best places to acquire additional long-term secure income is by delaying Social Security. So if in any of the scenarios he looked at, couple, individual, survivors, in any of those, if there was identified the need for additional secure income, the first place I would consider going is delaying Social Security, because it is not, Social Security benefits are not determined by current interest rates. In the current interest rate environment, it is expensive to generate secure income. So going to a source like Social Security that is not affected by these low interest rates that we see these days is a very attractive place to go and acquire additional secure income. But if he doesn't need it, I'd say I have no problem with him claiming at 62, if he wants to do that.
I like your answer, and I'm going to refrain from adding to it because the very next question kind of ties into the same thing. So we'll opine on that one.
His next question or a whole other person?
Whole other person.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Kind of relates to it as, okay. as you were going on. Mm-hmm. I was
and looking, on and on.
And on and on and on mm-hmm. and on, as you usually do. I was looking through our list, a stack of questions. These questions, folks, are a surprise to me as well on what I decide to answer. So I'm often looking through them as Chris and I are talking. So this next question is eerily similar, mm-hmm. but a little bit different. And it's from a North Carolinian. It says, greetings mm-hmm. from North Carolina. And thank you for taking Cam Newton.
What? Oh, from to New England.
To New England, mm-hmm. yes.
That
yes.
Was, so that was directed directly at you.
That was directed directly at mm-hmm. me for us taking mm-hmm. Cam Newton. Well, it was either Cam or no one, because that's what we had. Like, now I know.
They could have shopped around.
Now I know what the NFL, other NFL teams went through for the last 20 years.
Trying to find a quarterback?
It stinks trying to find a quarterback and not playing well.
For sure.
So, anyways. Greetings from North Carolina, and thank you for taking Cam Newton. During this crazy year, several organizations are offering early retirement packages, and I may be offered just such a package. What do you think of the idea, instead of taking a lump sum buyout from my employer? No. I think he wrote this wrong. What do you think of the idea instead of, I think he meant to say instead of taking a pension, but, oh no, okay. This is a little worded strangely, so hopefully everyone can understand this. I'm going to back up and just read through this, Chris, without pausing, and tell me if it doesn't make any sense afterwards.
Okay.
During this crazy year, several organizations are offering early retirement packages, and I may be offered just such a package. What do you think of the idea of, instead of taking a lump sum buyout from my employer, having them roll the money directly into my IRA or company 401k plan to avoid the tax hit on taking a payout? This, of course, assumes I do not need the entire buyout to make ends meet until I find a new job. I am over the age of 55, so if I put it into my 401k plan, I can take withdrawals when needed. Obviously, I will have to pay taxes, but not the 10% early withdrawal penalty. If the company puts the money into my IRA, I need to wait until 59 and a half in 14 months to avoid early withdrawal penalties. Curious on your take as to my possible options and things I may want to consider, pros and cons. Now, before we get into some of what he wrote, the reason I said it's similar to what you were answering is he's contemplating taking a payout from a pension, Chris, rather than the pension.
I don't think that's what he's asking, actually, Jim.
Oh.
He's just asking, they want him to go away and retire, and they're offering to give him a lump sum of money. This isn't taking his pension. This is the buyout.
Oh, it's not a pension?
I don't think so. He never mentioned that. So I think it's just a lump sum buyout, and he's thinking instead of them just handing me this money in one lump sum and I take it and recognize it as taxable income.
Oh, no,
like
no, he can't
bonus.
Just put it in the 401k and the IRA.
Right. Well, well, he could defer up to contribution limits into the 401k. He's not going to get squat into the IRA because he's going to be capped by the contribution limits. So he's not going to be able to put a bunch in there, and an employer isn't going to pay directly to it anyway. So it's just going to be his contribution. But that's not going to accomplish anything unless he has a much, much lower paying job than I think, and the buyout's only $6,000 or something like that.
Okay, so you're saying they might pay him to retire.
Yeah, I think they're just going to pay him to retire because he never mentions a pension. He just calls it a buyout.
Okay.
So I think it's just instead of what do we think of him instead of just taking it all as one lump sum, and this is more of a tax question. what do your taxes look like? Is, you know, in this, if the buyout happens mid-year and it's not for a huge amount, then it's going to be, that year is going to be not much different than your regular income year. And depending on what you already have deferred, you may not need a lot more money deferred. So you might not want to try to convince them to shove up to certain limits money into the 401k instead of paying it out to you. So yeah, I would say, first of all, you need to clarify what are they offering and what are the choices. I think you're imagining choices that may or may not even exist. Now, most places will let you elect to max out the contributions, for instance, into your 401k. But usually a, quote, buyout is going to be a lot bigger than just a single year's worth of contribution to a 401k. Maybe you could negotiate that it straddles two tax years or something and do some more, you know, do something more creative there. But you're not going to be able to take several hundred thousand dollars and have them defer it into the 401k. It doesn't work that way. The only way you're going to do that are for people that have what Jim thought you had, which is a pension, and you choosing to cash out the pension. Those, as long as it is qualified in the right way, can be rolled over into your 401k. I just dealt with someone recently that did that exact thing. They chose they wanted the lump sum rather than the pension payments, and they're rolling the big lump sum amount over into the company's 401k. That was allowed. Maybe that is one of the choices here, but that's not a buyout. That's just electing the lump sum payment and shoving it over into the 401k, which could then ultimately be rolled out to an IRA if they choose to do so. But I don't think we're either not getting all the story, or it's just a simple cash buyout, which is probably not going to have a lot of options, other than if he wants to defer it and the company is flexible enough, ask for it to be paid out over a few tax years instead of taking it as a lump sum. Ask him to split it up between this year and next year, or 21 and 22 or something like that. I've seen that a lot of times when they're trying to negotiate some kind of buyout. People don't want to recognize 2 or 3 years worth of income all in 1 year. Sounds great till you consider the taxes, and then it's a bad idea. So you convince them to, you know, split it up. They usually won't split it up over a real long period of time. In my experience, a couple, 2 years, 3 years is going to be the maximum, because they want to cut ties with you. They don't want you lingering around in the system. They want you to be done with them. So the best you can usually hope for is just, you know, a couple year straddle. Past, you know, put it on two tax years or something like that. But I think that's where he was asking the question, is that what can he do with that lump sum cash buyout?
Okay. Well, with that in mind, then, what I would encourage this listener and the previous listener, a lot of these questions that they're asking us, Chris, really revolve around the art of financial planning, mm-hmm. or in this case, retirement planning. That's what we specialize in. But what I mean by that, folks, and we've said this before on the show, true financial planning, I think, is 50% art, 50% science. The science part is pretty much steeped in these are the rules, this is how it works. And we often use the rules of required minimum distributions, must begin by the year you turn 72 now. That's a fact. That's the science part. It's a hard fact. RMDs, required minimum distributions, begin in the year you turn 72. The art part of financial planning, or retirement planning in this case, is really open to interpretation. And truly, if you got 3, 4, 5, 6 different financial planners in a room and gave them the same question, especially loaded ones like this, they kind of open-ended, we could take this question and the previous question, Chris, and put 50 different what-if scenarios in them, as you know, mm-hmm. and go down 50 different rabbit holes. So there's a lot that needs to be defined and explained and understood. And obviously, in a short Q&A format that we have on this podcast, and most advisors who do podcasts or radio shows similar to ours also have on their shows, where we're just answering, for the most part, in generalizations, the art part. If it's a science part of financial planning, Chris and I will go deep into the facts and explain them to you. But if it's an art part, it's hard for us to do that. And to me, in both these situations, Chris, they need a retirement analysis. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying that because that's what we do and that's what we offer. Hell, we have a pause right now. We're not accepting new retirement planning clients at the moment. So it's not about trying to drum up more work for us. It's trying to give these two individuals sound, concrete advice. Don't listen to two yahoos on a podcast or some guy on the radio on Saturday morning. You need to look at this situation with accurate data and number crunching and forward-looking projections to give you clarity and the understanding to make an informed decision, the ability to program in what ifs, the ability to put in your specific financial situation and look at every small nuance. That's what a planner does, and that's what these two listeners need with these art-style questions. Mm-hmm. They really need a plan, Chris. Now, whether they decide to do it on their own, whether they decide to find some website and try to do it online, or whether they decide to hire actual human advisors like you and I, they need to get a plan in place and then look at all the variables and then make a decision. That's my take. For us to sit here and list every possible variable and what-if scenarios and think of this and that situation and this and that situation, we'd beat that horse to death eventually. No one would want to listen to us. So you need to get this calculation, this uncertainty ironed out, but base it on sound, forward-looking projections that can give you the confidence and clarity and direction to make these decisions. And that's what a sound retirement plan will do.
Yeah, I think retirement planning is a lot like building a house from the raw materials, from the wood and the concrete and the metal and the cabinets and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, you head into retirement, you've assembled all these raw materials, now you've got to build the house. And there's not just one way to build it, right? There's all kinds of different ways to build it. There's certain things you have to do. You have to meet code. You know, it's appropriate you do this, that, and the other thing. There's some engineering, scientific parts of it. But how you put it together, you know, what the architect might do for you is the art part. And it kind of depends on what you want the house to look like. Here, this does really ask the question, what do you want your retirement to look like? What are you trying to do with these resources? There's not just one way to do this. There's not just one way to build the house. So, yeah, I agree that they're kind of general in nature, and there isn't one way to do this. And it would really take a lot of inward asking yourselves the how do I want my house to look kind of questions. And then if you can't build it yourself, which a lot of people can't, you know, that's when you get some professional help, right? And an architect and a construction manager and all those folks, and then they can hopefully build the house that you want, giving you some guidance along the way and that kind of thing. But it's very personal, and yeah, there's not one way to do it, and we don't know how they want their house to look, so we can't give them the one best answer, even if there could be identified one best answer to build a certain type of house.
Exactly. So let's get into questions that we can give a little more definitive answers to, although this next one has got a lot of art in it as well, but there's more science than the previous questions, I think. Okay. This is a very long question, so a listener who wrote this, I apologize, I'm not going to read the entire thing. I'm going to try to get to the meat and potatoes, as they say. Anyways, this comes to us from, well, I don't know where he lives. I know everything else about him because he shared it all with us, but he didn't share where he lives. He gave his real name, but as always, we are going to call him George to protect his anonymity. So he begins and he says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. I retired this year at the age of 54 and recently started listening to your podcast on my daily walks. After listening to only a few of your shows, I soon realized while I did a good job in planning to get to retirement, I did an awful job preparing for getting through retirement. But your show has opened to my eyes and probably added a bit of unexpected stress." Well, I hope we didn't add a lot of stress to them. I have a couple of questions on some strategies I would like to run by you to see if they make sense and ensure that I am not missing the obvious pitfalls before doing so. Below is some basic information about me. And that's what I'm going to skip. He really runs through his whole situation, where he lives. Oh, he lives in Texas. Duh. I said, I don't know where he lives. He's Texas, how many kids he has, his assets, all this. I'm going to skip through that and just highlight a few things. In 2020, he moved, Chris, his 401k to a traditional IRA, and he has no other IRA. Okay? Mm-hmm. After he retired, he moved his 401k. He does have regular brokerage account, what we call maybe taxable. And it generates about $15,000 a year of income. He also has position. Let me show if I can get this right. I'm going to read his sentence here. I liquidated all equity positions last year to protect these assets for my spending over the next 6 years. These assets are fairly protected and will provide minimal income of $15,000 a year, and they are earmarked to provide me with $120,000 of total spending a year until I reach age 60.
Okay.
Okay. All righty. He does have some pensions, but they don't start till later. I won't get into that. And then he wrote, as part of my separation from my company, I have a severance agreement that will pay me two installments of $150,000 each. The first installment will be paid, or was paid, in January of 2020, and the second will be paid in February 2021. Mm-hmm. My first question, and it's probably a no-brainer, he put in parentheses. I'm not saying it's a no-brainer. He said that. First question, and probably a no-brainer. Since my only earned income for 2020 and 2021 is my $150,000 severance, should my wife and I each make the maximum contribution of $7,000 to my traditional IRA? That is a loaded question that I could run in many different scenarios on. But the first thing I want to point out, listener, you said it was severance. You said you get $150,000 a year for 2 years. Severance may or may not count for an IRA contribution. Mm-hmm. So look on your 1099, excuse me, not your 1099, your W-2 when it comes into you. If the severance is reported in box one, it is taxable compensation and can be used for IRA contributions. But if it's paid out to you as some type of unemployment or through some type of insurance program that your employer has, it will not count for IRA contribution purposes. Right. So look on your W-2 and see if it's reported in box one. I'm going to assume it is. Most of the time it is. But I wanted to throw out there that it may or may not be reportable for IRA contribution purposes. His next part that he thinks is a no-brainer, I'm not certain is a no-brainer. I don't know if he should put the money in a traditional IRA and get a deduction now, or will he have higher taxes later, so he would be better off putting that money in a Roth IRA now. He will qualify for a Roth contribution. He's under the earnings limits. I don't know if that makes sense. He does have three children, so he's got a lot of all minor children, 15 and two 12-year-olds. He did indicate that. So he's going to have some good tax deductions. He might have very, very low taxes now, Chris. So the actual tax benefit of putting $14,000 a year for the next 2 years in an IRA might be minimal, but it might be little, and it's not going to be that great. I don't know. I'm not certain. And he might be better off maxing out the Roth in these lower brackets because he might be in higher brackets in the future. So I'm not certain it's a no-brainer. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is really a tax question more than anything. And without knowing what his tax forecast is, what he's got in always taxable and when it's going to be coming out, and does he have big, giant RMDs where his tax situation gets horrific when he turns 72, and some of these other things will help drive. Now, I will say a couple of years of these little contributions one way or another probably are not make or break decisions in retirement, and he might be putting way too much focus on things that don't have a lot of bearing overall, and he needs to be worried about other things. I would say in the list of priority items, I can't imagine this is up in the top three or four for someone heading into retirement. I think there's going to be far more consequential decisions for him to make, unless he's already made them and he's down on his list and he's at the bottom doing these kind of cleanup things. But for somebody who made got $150,000 coming in, a couple of little $7,000 contributions here at the tail end that have no long-term compounding or anything before retirement starts may or may not really make that much difference, honestly.
I agree. And I think he needs a plan as well. In an effort to be brief, because it didn't really apply to his two questions, he does lay out all his situation, and he's got a lot of moving parts. Mm-hmm. And I would hope he has a sound retirement plan. I think he needs it. But again, listener, I'm uncertain. If we're to just dumb this down to your question, I agree totally with Chris. You've got a lot of moving parts here that one must look at, not just whether or not you should put $14,000 in a traditional IRA, divided between an IRA for you and your wife, of course, over the next 2 years. I don't think that $28,000 is going to make one bit of difference. But if you want us to evaluate just that, I don't think with three children, $150,000 of income, and low taxes right now, the tax savings is going to be that great when you actually do your taxes between the standard deduction that you and your wife are going to have, the tax benefits of having your children. You might not get that big of a bang, and you might be better off just putting that money into a Roth. And the reason I say that, Chris, his very next question is this. Second question. Since I will have no earned income and only about $15,000 of taxable investment income from the years 2022 through 2025 before I hit age 60, can I convert my IRA to a Roth IRA at that time up to the maximum amount to keep me in the 10% tax bracket? The 10% bracket, probably not. Your $15,000 of investment income is going to fill up a lot of that bracket anyways, even though it's going to be subject to maybe capital gains taxes. I'm not sure how your investment income is going to be taxed to you. The 10% bracket isn't that big. I think you can fill some of the 12% bracket, but the 10% bracket is a stretch. And I don't think you should ignore the 12% bracket. Why stop at 10?
Yeah, 12 is still pretty darn cheap.
Yeah, 12 is pretty darn good, and you're most likely, with the amount of assets you have, when true retirement sets in and you're collecting Social Security, you're collecting the two pensions. Remember, Chris, I did indicate he had two pensions. When you're turning on your pensions, turning on your Social Security, being forced to take required minimum distributions, you're going to blow through the 12 bracket. So if you're going to try doing some conversions when your $150,000 stops after 2 years, I think you should look at converting through the 12. And a sound retirement plan, especially if it was done correctly or at least with good software, is going to be able to project for you the estimated tax brackets you will be in throughout retirement. And you should look at them as a couple with your wife, but also as a widow and a widower. And start also looking at this through the eyes of a couple, a widow, or a widower. Remember, we call that 210 planning. Are you trying to reduce taxes for two of you as a couple? one of you as a widow or a widower, or none of you as an inheritance to your children. 2-1-0. Who are we tax planning for? You're not telling me that, but you need to evaluate that. Because I feel perhaps getting as much money into a Roth as possible in your tax planning window is going to be very important to you or for you as you progress through retirement. And I don't know how many more years of the Trump tax cuts we're going to have before. I know they expire January 1st of 2026, but I don't know if a new Congress or a new White House is going to work on dismantling those tax cuts sooner rather than later. But we do know taxes are going up. So you might have an opportunity, Chris, after the 150,000 stops to, I think, Phil, not only the 10, but the 12, and an argument could be made, perhaps the 24 bracket, because the 24 bracket is going to become the 28 bracket.
Well, the 22 bracket.
The 22 bracket first. Is going to become, right, excuse me, I forgot. It's the 22 bracket now, which is going to become the 25 bracket when the tax cuts expire. And that's the bracket you might be in, or the next one above that, 28, I believe it is.
It's 24 now.
24 going to 28. Mm-hmm. So you have an opportunity now to take advantage of the lower tax cuts from the previous administration, well, soon to be previous administration, and to start planning for higher taxes that are legislatively set to happen in 2026, but might happen even sooner. So I think you need a plan to start looking at this. But in summary, for your two questions, I think you should consider a Roth, maybe not an IRA for your first question. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think you may want to. And then I think you may want to convert at least into the 12 bracket, maybe beyond that. And one other thing, nowhere in his writing to me does he indicate what he's doing for health care. But he does have ample money and maybe taxable money, Chris. Mm-hmm. So it tells me he could also be doing some serious ACA planning.
Yeah.
And if he does do ACA tax credit planning, it's going to close the door on Roth conversion abilities, but it could give him and his wife $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 each in premium tax credits every year.
Well, he still could convert through the 12 and still manage pretty close to through the 12. It's the top of the 12 is about where the ACA premium tax credits go away for a married filing joint couple. And they might have a little better situation with their kids overall. But yeah, he doesn't mention medical, but he's clearly fairly young as a retiree. So medical is always this big question for people before their Medicare age. What the heck are you doing? Because it could be substantial cost for this medical, and giving up those credits is a big tax consequence when you're thinking about doing conversions. Well, on to the next question. Jim actually had to bail out after that last question, had something that came up. So I'm going to deal with a Social Security question that just came in recently to kind of wrap up today's Q&A show. So this email comes in from North Carolina. They were kind enough to describe to Jim how glorious it is there. So in his search for the prime retirement location for himself, they proposed kind of the Asheville, North Carolina area. We heard that several times. So this person was kind enough to heed or respond to our call for additional Social Security questions. So this is a Social Security related question. It's really kind of them reaching out for some confirmation about their approach and if this sounds like it's a reasonable way to go. I will say that it's hard to ever answer these for sure because Social Security is just a part of an entire retirement plan, and there's a lot of other resources likely involved that need to be coordinated with Social Security to kind of determine if you're taking the optimal approach. But I think it's worthy to kind of remind people of a few of the basic rules here. They've got it pretty much nailed. There's not really many mistakes here per se, although one comment I want to clarify. So let's just get into their situation here. I'm 67 and my wife is 65. She plans to file for her benefit when she reaches her full retirement age at 66 and 2 months, which will be in December of 2021. Her benefit will be $12.49 per month. Since I was born in September 1953, I plan to file for a spousal benefit when she files to receive half her benefit amount of $624.50, while allowing my own benefit to grow. So let me pause there, because some of you might say, no, can't do that anymore. Well, you can if you were born before January 2nd of 1954, and if you check your calendar there at home, September of 1953 is in fact prior to January 2nd of 1954, so he is grandfathered into what's called filing a restricted application. He is going to file a restricted application just for his spousal benefit on his wife's record, which he'll be entitled to after she is, he'll be eligible for it after she files in December of 2021. That opens the door to the spousal benefit. He becomes entitled when he then files and starts receiving the benefit. Those of you techies or geeks out there will notice that there is a difference between being eligible for Social Security and being entitled to Social Security. And there's actually a third category called potentially entitled, but I don't want to deviate too much from the topic here. But words mean things, so I'm going to be careful to use the right words here. And he's allowed to file this restricted application because he's grandfathered into that. So he's going to let his own grow to 70 while collecting a spousal benefit. That's gone now for people born January 2nd and after of 1954. So that will slowly close as the as January 1st of 2024 rolls around. There will no longer be anyone who will benefit from this, and that strategy will be gone forever unless they bring it back. So back on to his. We're using generous stock options from my last employer as a bridge to Social Security. Those are considered ordinary income by the IRS. But since neither of us are applying for benefits until we reach full retirement age or later, I don't think our benefits would be subject to an earnings test. So let me pause right there and clarify something. He's claiming that he's not going to be subject to the earnings test because they will claim after they reach full retirement age, which is true. But it implies, his comment implies, that if they weren't full retirement age, those stock options would have caused him to be subjected to the earnings test. That's not true. Those stock options, if he's in fact retired, those stock options are compensation for work he's done previously before he would have been claiming Social Security. And so stock options, deferred compensation, delayed commissions for work that you did before, just because you're being paid in a particular year and paying taxes on it. The IRS is right. They're going to consider that as taxable income when he's exercising those stock options and then maybe selling the stock that he got from those stock options. That's an event on his taxes on his 1040. That's not income to be considered in the earnings test for Social Security benefits. So, yeah, just wanted to clear that up because I have the sense that he believes that if he was filing before his full retirement age, those stock options would cause him to be subject to the earnings test. They would not. Moving along, I will apply for my own benefit at 70 in September of 2023. My benefit at that time will be $38.92 per month. Based on your guidance, I believe my wife can then file for her own spousal benefit, which would be half of what my full retirement age benefit would have been at 66. My benefit at that time would have been $29.95, making her spousal benefit about $1,500 a month, which is about a $250 increase from what she files for on her own benefit in December of 2021. And that's true. So there's some moving parts here. She files at 66 and 2 months, he simultaneously files for just a spousal benefit. They roll along until September of 2023, so almost 2 years, when he then turns on his now maximized age 70 benefit, which unlocks the door for her to receive a spousal benefit. And those paying attention at home will remember that when you're receiving a spousal benefit, they technically are paying your own benefit first and then topping you up. She's already collecting $1,250. She's owed $1,500. So they're going to increase her benefit, that $250 for $1,500, and they'll go about their business there with him collecting about $3,900 a month and her collecting about $1,500 a month until the first of them passes. This isn't part of his email, but just a reminder to everybody in the story. When the first of them passes, the survivor will keep his benefit, the $3,900. Just this for some reason has been coming up a lot in questions that people forget or don't realize that delayed retirement credits, the delay, the growth on the benefit from him delaying to 70 passes on to the survivor. So it's spousal benefits that don't get any delayed retirement credit benefits increases, but survivor benefits, any that are earned when the person passes away, stay. The survivor receives them. Even if the person delaying hadn't yet filed. I get this a lot too. Someone was delaying to 70, but they died at 69. They, in anticipation of that possibility, they start kind of thinking again about delaying. Well, if my spouse is going to give those up, why should I delay? They don't give them up. You don't have to have filed for those delayed retirement credits to be been awarded to you. You are awarded them. Up until the point when you pass. Think of it this way. Your survivor will receive your benefit as a survivor benefit, whatever you were receiving at the time or what you could potentially have been receiving had you filed as a worst case scenario. Sometimes you get more than that, right? There are certain, if you claim early, sometimes there's some survivor protection rules that increase the benefit actually. Not going to get into that today, but just wanted to remind people of the benefit of his strategy. He's getting paid to wait, which is always attractive. It's better than not being paid to wait. He's getting that $625 a month while he waits to 70. Then he turns on, she gets an increase, and they go about their business, having a maximized age 70 benefit for him that will now last as long as either one of them are alive. So sounds pretty good, actually, George. We'll call him from North Carolina. So thanks for sending this in. It had several moving parts that were good to remind people about. And I don't see anything defective in your approach. The only thing I felt like I was kind of correcting is what it seems that you thought that the earnings test would play a part with those stock options if either of you were claiming before full retirement age. But that is not the case. That would not have. That's not a factor here. You don't have to worry about it because you're not claiming till after full retirement age anyway, but you would have been forgiven. So that's our last question for the day. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to send in your own questions, send it over, get in contact with us at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form you'll find. You can read a little bit more about us. Submit a question for this show or an idea for our EDU show. We're finished up recording this the week before Thanksgiving. I know people's Thanksgivings are being disrupted a bit because of the latest increase in all of the numbers we don't want to see increased. But everybody make the best of it. Looks like next year will be much, much better, assuming things progress as we see them. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll be back next week with another new Q&A show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.